This is the What Matters Most podcast. A 100% listener-supported program. And now, here is your host, Paul Samuel Dolman.
Well, welcome back to What Matters Most. Thank you for everyone around the world that's been tuning in and also letting me know what you think and guest suggestions, book suggestions, and sharing your story. And the Patreons who support the show, Matthew Wayne Selznick, our technical wizard out on the West Coast. And I think our audience is about 500,000 folks these days. So thank you all over. I can't believe it. But it's really because the guests are fantastic. And today's guest has been on multiple times. A hero of mine going way back. I remember reading his early work, like The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight or The Prophet's Way. And I think I've pretty much read almost everything he's done. His new book, again, is timely. It's an incredible education, but it's also compelling the way he writes. It's The Hidden History of Neoliberalism, How Reaganism Gutted America, and How to Restore Its Greatness. It's from the New York Times bestselling author and our friend, my friend, the inspirational Tom Hartman. Welcome back.
Paul, thanks so much for having me on your program. It's always an honor.
I don't want to waste a lot of time with small talk because this book is so important, but I did want to just get your feedback, as we always do, on the state of the moment. We had an FBI raid at Mar-a-Lago. We have midterms on the horizon, although it's only August when we're taping this. What are your feelings in general about the landscape of the current now?
I think that this fall is going to be very good to Democrats. Between the Dobbs decision, the abortion decision, the Republican refusal to do anything even rationally meaningful, you know, broad consensus about guns, you know, like an assault weapons ban, the general insanity of the party and many of the people in it. And it's just like, you know, they keep shooting themselves in the foot. They voted down a $35 cap on insulin prices. I think the only thing left for basically white people to vote for Republicans is their naked racism. And and the economy is doing well. We just had a great jobs report. Joe Biden has created more jobs in the first 2 years of his presidency than any president in the history of the United States. I'm optimistic. Knock wood.
What does the Republican Party even stand for anymore? And I'm not trying to be funny or satirical. I can't figure it out. The insulin thing, just who's against insulin for people who are diabetic who will die? And then they also voted down this benefits for the veterans that had 85% popularity. What is that party even about these days?
Well, you know, in part, the veterans thing, it was, we're going to screw the Democrats. It was just, you know, childish schoolyard bully stuff. But, you know, in serious answer to a serious question, what does the Republican Party stand for? From the beginning of our republic until today, there has always been typically a faction within a party, occasionally an entire party, that was really committed to the interests of the rich, you know, of the few. And they developed elaborate rationalizations around that. You know, the early Federalists, Jefferson used to call them out for this. He said the Federalist Party is the party of the well-born and the well-bred. And the Federalists went down in flames and got replaced by the Whigs. And the Whigs were just as business friendly as the Federalists, particularly going up against Andrew Jackson's, progressive populism or democratic populism. And then it got a little muddier, you know, through most of the rest of the 19th century and the early 20th century, because Teddy Roosevelt was a progressive and William Howard Taft, two Republican presidents, were progressives. But by 1933, it became very clear that the Democratic Party was the party of the average working person and the Republican Party was the party of big business and fat cats. And so, you know, basically what the Republican Party stands for right now is the interests of anybody who has a net worth of, you know, over $50 million and any corporation that's willing to make large political contributions.
And more against everything than for any one policy. They can't really put forward a policy platform. And when Trump ran and lost to Biden, they basically didn't have a platform at the convention. It was whatever Trump thinks was their take.
Right. And that was because, you know, what they had been doing since 1980, which, by the way, was a repeat of what they did in 1920, which is a really interesting story. In fact, if it's not in this book, it's in my book on oligarchy, was, you know, selling trickle down economics. In other words, we want to cut taxes on really rich people and shovel what turned out to be, since 1980, $50 trillion out of the wealth, out of the homes and assets of the bottom 90% into the money bins of the top 0.1%. And you know, back in the 20s, it was called horse and sparrow economics. This is what Warren Harding ran on in 1920. In 1920, of course, half the roads in America still had horses on them. And the theory was that if you overfeed your horses, if you give them more oats than they actually need, then their horse poop is really rich in oats, and the sparrows will eat the oats out of the cow pies or the horse pies, you know, the horse poop. And therefore the sparrows will get fattened up too. And it was called horse and sparrow economics. You can Google it. And, you know, that was something that was very popular among the very rich from about the 1880s until the great crash, you know, in the beginning of the Republican Great Depression in 1929. So Reagan reinvented that and called it trickle-down economics, that, you know, if we pour a lot of money into the top through largely through tax cuts, then those wealthy people will use that money to buy factories and raise the wages of their working people. It was a lie then. It's been a lie consistently. But what's happened, I think, in the 42 years since Reagan started that sales pitch is that probably about a decade ago or so, people stopped believing it. You know, they just saw the evidence. Their paychecks were getting smaller. Life was getting harder. They were getting poorer. They were losing their assets. It took two people to maintain the same standard of living by about 10 years ago as it did in 1981. And so Trump came along and started basically telling the truth, which was a pretty shocking thing. You know, he said the situation is rigged. He stood up on the stage in the first Republican primary and said, you know, everybody on this stage is going to take money from the rich people and they're going to work for the rich people. And I'm not going to, because I am a rich person and I can fund myself. And, you know, they tell you that they want to cut your taxes, but they're really going to cut the taxes of the rich people. And they tell you they want to bring home the jobs, but they really are taking money from the corporations that are making things in China. And everybody was like, holy crap, you know, he's talking like Bernie Sanders. He's telling the truth. And that's a large part, I think, of why Trump became president. Now, once he became president, of course, we discovered that, like with almost every other thing that Donald Trump says, it was just a lie. And you know, he pushed through the largest tax cut in history. I mean, you know, it was a $2 trillion tax cut over a 2-year period, but over the next 10 years, it's going to be, you know, at least a $10 trillion tax cut, and exclusively for the rich people. And the few little crumbs that he threw to the people, you know, making under $150,000 that they used to sell it, they all expire next year. I think people, another reason to have optimism, I think people are figuring out, you know, I mean, even Trump's effort to bring back manufacturing from China, you know, he put some tariffs on some Chinese goods, but the Chinese knew it was a joke because he didn't even bother to try to get it through Congress. I mean, if you want to have a tariff that's going to, you know, companies work on 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 year timelines. You know, they don't make decisions about what's going to happen in the next 2 years. They make decisions. It takes more than 2 years to build a damn factory. So when Trump put the tariffs on using an executive order, which would be reversed by the next president, you know, it was only going to last at the most 3 years. You know, everybody in China and everybody in American business just shrugged their shoulders and ignored it. And, you know, if he was serious, he would have gone to Congress and said, you know, we need these tariffs. But he wasn't serious. It was just, you know, a sales pitch. So, you know, that's where we're at. And that's why I think that, and that's why, in part why I wrote the book, because, you know, this, you know, low taxes on rich people, gut labor unions, reduce the political power of the average working person, These are the core tenets of, oh, and so-called free trade, you know, allow corporations to find the cheapest labor on the planet rather than having to deal with, you know, what's in the best interest of your nation. These are the core tenets of neoliberalism. And so, you know, I put it all together in the book.
This may sound like a hack question, but I'm sure some people around the world are asking it. Why do they call it neoliberalism?
That's a good question. It was invented. It came out of a meeting in the first meeting was in 1938 during World War II in Paris. But the meeting that really nailed it down was in 1947 in Switzerland near Lake Geneva on what we would call Mount Pelerin. They call it Mont Pelerin there. In fact, they named the neoliberal society after it, the Mont Pelerin Society. And it was a group of, as I recall, 38 men, all men. Most of them were economists. There were a couple of other people who were famous in their fields, you know, a writer, a philosophers and whatnot. And they were trying to figure out how they had just seen in their lifetimes Russia turn into a communist dictatorship, and one of the most vibrant democracies in Europe, Germany, turn into a fascist dictatorship. You know, so you have dictatorship of the left and dictatorship of the right. So their question was, is it possible to create a form of government that is not vulnerable to becoming either fascist nor communist, which is a noble idea. And being economists, you know, Abraham Maslow, the famous psychologist, had this saying, you know, when the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And being economists, they thought, okay, an economic system has to be the solution to this. So the idea of an unregulated economy, which in the United States we would call libertarianism or conservative economic policies, in Europe, that's referred to as liberal economics. Now, liberal means a completely different thing here in the United States. But to Europeans, the word liberal means basically unregulated, free market. You know, the market makes its decisions rather than the government. But they didn't want to just be classical European liberals, the kind of Adam Smith laissez-faire liberals. They wanted to be, they wanted to bring some new things to it. And so they added the Greek word neo, which means new, to liberal, and thus it's the new liberalism. We would, if it was being named in America, we would call it neoconservatism, except that label's already taken. And besides that, neoliberalism is well established around the world. It is confusing for a lot of people. And I really, with my publisher, I mean, we really debated making that the title, but you know, I think more and more we did some surveys or looked at surveys and found that, you know, for people over 50, neoliberalism is a confusing word. But for people under 30, there's a broad, widespread understanding of what neoliberalism is. So, you know, we went with that as a title.
Brilliantly explained. And also massive buildup in defense spending under all of this.
Yeah, that's typically characteristic of neoliberalism, because neoliberalism preaches that the government really only has a couple functions. One is to provide an army to defend the country. The other is to provide police to maintain law and order. And the third is to maintain a court system to not just adjudicate crimes, but also to adjudicate disputes between corporations, between parties, to deal with business disputes. And so that's what we've got.
How is that different than just sort of a corporate fascist model and the corporate power, the pure hyper corporate capitalism that we're experiencing? Or are they sort of hand in hand evil sisters?
That really is neoliberalism. I mean, we have been living in a largely neoliberal era ever since 1981. Prior to 81, we were using John Maynard Keynes's system, which was really just a well-regulated variation on Adam Smith and David Ricardo's, you know, Adam Smith from 1776, Wealth of Nations, David Ricardo on labor, 1819, you know, their understanding of economics, that economics is a game. It's like a football game, you know, and And if you had no rules to a football game, or if the rule was whichever team gives the biggest donation to the NFL and have an extra player on the field throughout the game, you know, it really wouldn't be a particularly fun game to watch after a while. And that's kind of where we're at now, is the particularly since the Supreme Court legalized political bribery. You know, whichever group gets the largest donations from billionaires and corporations ends up typically winning elections and getting their way.
Why did it take so long for this to peter out when I could see how heinous and horrible it was pretty early on? It has gutted so many of the what would have been the better parts of the American dream, the middle class, upward mobility. How is it, I mean, stuck around? It's only benefiting a few people. You would think people would have caught on a lot sooner, since the people it helps is such a microscopic segment of society.
Yeah. Well, you know, Reagan came along at just the right moment for him. You had, first of all, Nixon in 72 took us off the gold standard. Because that caused the dollar to get a whole lot stronger, which made American exports harder to sell, he put into place the first official devaluation of the U.S. currency in the history of America. He devalued our currency by 11% in 72, and then in 74, he did it again for another 10%. So you had a 20% devaluation, or 21% devaluation of the U.S. dollar, and you know, which in and of itself wouldn't have had a huge domestic effect, other than, you know, slightly increasing the price of imports. But we didn't, you know, back then, Sam Walton's slogan for Walmart was 100% made in the USA. So Nixon did that. And then what happened in 70, whatever the year was, I forget, I think it was 73, was the Arab-Israeli war. And we took the side of Israel. And so the Arabs cut off oil to us for about a year. And the result of that, because, you know, was that the price of oil went to over $100 a barrel. And because oil just drives everything. I mean, we make fertilizer out of oil, our tractors run on oil, our trucks run on oil, our power plants, so the majority of them run on oil. That increased the price of everything in America, which is what we call inflation. And typically when you have what's called an exogenous inflation shock, you know, an externally caused inflation shock like we had with that, and then it on top of the 21% devaluation of our currency, which made oil even more expensive. Typically, when you have an external shock, it takes about a decade. I mean, you know, you can go all the way back to the American Revolution and find about a dozen of these kind of situations. And in almost every case, it takes about a decade for that inflation to work itself out of the economy, to wring itself out. Sometimes if you recover rapidly from it, or if the cause of the shock goes away quickly, it only takes a year or two, which is what happened in 1946 after the end of World War II. We had, you know, 13% inflation in 46, and by 47, it was down to 7 or 8%. And I think by 49, it was pretty much normal. But don't quote me on those numbers. That's from memory. But it's in that neighborhood. And but that oil price shock was so huge, and it was so systemic. There is nothing else in our economy that has that kind of systemic impact other than oil, that the inflation was still going after Nixon turned the country over to Jerry Ford. And Jerry Ford had his whip inflation now thing, his win buttons. But that didn't slow down inflation. And then Jimmy Carter came in, and you know, it was just starting to ring out in the last couple of years of the Carter presidency. And finally, the last two or three years of the Reagan presidency is when the inflation ended, which is exactly what you could have predicted when the oil price went up in 73. You know, it would take a decade. Well, guess what? 83 is when it was all gone. But the bottom line is that, you know, when Reagan came into office, most people weren't thinking like that, or didn't even know that. In fact, it was still a matter of dispute among economists. And so Reagan basically blamed the inflation on Jimmy Carter, although he had inherited it from Jerry Ford. But, you know, memories are short. And Reagan's and people were pretty down about the economy because of that inflation, you know, and then Volcker had raised interest rates I bought a house in 81, and I think I paid a 13 or 14% mortgage on it. Yeah. And so, you know, people were bummed out about the economy. And so Reagan came in and said, you know, it's sunshine in America. I'm going to make everything wonderful. And we're going to, you know, rebuild the country, blah, blah, blah. And you know, what came out of that was people were willing to give him a chance. People were willing to trust him and believe him. And when he said, you know, government's not the solution to your problem, government is the problem, in his inaugural address on January 20th, 81, and then started, you know, and then went after the unions and said the unions are part of the inflation problem, and busted PATCO and et cetera. And started, you know, state after state started passing right to work for less laws and stuff like that. The people gave it a shot. So I think that's part of it, that you know, we gave him the benefit of the doubt. He was such a friendly seeming guy, and he smiled and told a lot of jokes. And then the other part of it was that there's a theory that I actually give some credibility to. I don't reference it in the book, but that basically, America, not just America, you can find the same thing throughout European history, tends to run on 80-year cycles. And those 80-year cycles have two halves. And the two halves are that, you know, a new economic and political system comes into fashion. In the case, just to use the last 80 years of America as the example, Strauss and Howe, in their book, The Fourth Turning, attribute this to the generations. So the generation that, you know, that you start out with a generation that has a depression and a war. Okay, that would be my grandfather's generation. And that generation gets through that, and they give birth to a generation, my dad's generation. He was born in 30, whatever it was, 36, I think. And that generation, maybe 33, and that generation then are the quiet, slow builders. You know, they just rebuild the country step by step. And then that generation, which would be my generation, gives birth to a generation that says, well, you know, our parents built the country back, but, you know, they don't seem very happy. Let's get high and party and, you know, and maybe do some spiritual exploration and navel gazing and stuff. And of course, I did all those things, as did most of my peers. And so that's the third generation. And then they give birth to a generation, you know, my kids' generation, who look around and say, well, you know, our parents, you know, thought they were going to get enlightened, but they're no more enlightened than anybody else. And you know, screw this stuff. I'm going to get rich. And so then you're back. Then you've got a generation that engages in all kinds of economic excesses. And, you know, you have a bubble, and then the bubble bursts and the economy crashes, and you're back so this is the fourth generation. Now you're back to that first generation of the cycle that is going to live through a crash and a war, and it starts all over again. Well, in those four generations, that 80-year cycle, a generation is 20 years, you know, the first of those four cycles, they buy into an economic theory. In the case of my grandfather's generation, it was FDR. And hey, you know, let's have a very active government that puts the country back together after the war and the crash and makes things happen. And then the generation after them, my father's generation, was like, yeah, okay, we'll go along with that and we'll build. And then by the time you get to that third generation, 40 years on, they're starting to say, you know, it's not working all that well. And that's when Reagan came into office. You know, we got this inflation and things just aren't all that great. And so let's try something new. And Reagan comes along and says, hey, let's try neoliberalism. And then you've got 40 years of that. And it takes about 40 years for people to realize that something really isn't working, or to see the flaws in it. You know, it's kind of like midlife crisis thing, you know. And so I think that we are at the tail end of that 40-year cycle that started in 1981. We're actually 41 years into it. And that gives me a lot of hope. I think the next year or two or three or four are going to see a really substantial swing back to what you might call the left. I would call it the middle, because, you know, the vast majority, well over 50% of Americans, want a national healthcare system, want Social Security and Medicare to be strengthened, want good public schools, want free college, you know, want their children to have good opportunities. They want unions and good pay in the workplace. You know, I realize that on TV they refer to that as an extreme leftist agenda, but I really think it is the middle, and I think you're going to see a huge swing back to that over the near term, and perhaps where we started this conversation, Paul, perhaps we'll see that swing happen in the election this fall. In part, you know, supercharged by abortion and guns in particular.
Wow, thank you for the most incredible history lesson as always. I live for these when you come on, and you've made me optimistic, which is hard to do these days, even though I'm a happy, even though I'm a basically happy person. It's sort of like, oh, the asteroid's going to miss? Yeah, it looks like 98%.
I'm actually optimistic. You know, I think if we the all bets are off if we end up with President DeSantis. I think Trump is toast, but you know, if we end up with a real fascist as a president, it's going to get real, real rough for a while. But I do think that we're at the tail end of this neo-fascist, neoliberal regime.
Well, if we get a fascist president, you and I will be broadcasting as neighbors from the Algarve region in Portugal or somewhere on the Mediterranean.
Oh yeah, it'll be just like Hungary. We'll be in jail or we'll be exiled.
Yeah, we'll have to go, hopefully, but I'll be out ahead of that, and I'll be sending you, like in Casablanca, I'll be giving you letters of transit to grab.
I have your number, Paul.
You do, and you can hold me to it. I'll have the Hartman guest house. Hey, is neoliberalism and a healthy, thriving democracy, are they incompatible?
Yeah, you know, I had Stephen Moore on my show back about a decade ago, the guy who was, you know, Trump's economic advisor, and he was Reagan's economic advisor. And I asked him right up, I said, you know, which is more important, democracy or capitalism? And he said, why, capitalism, of course. And neoliberalism is, you know, unregulated capitalism. It's you know, the NFL without any rules, or with rules that only favor whoever gives the most money to the NFL. And therefore neoliberalism, which you know supercharges the power of capitalism, is almost by definition antithetical to representative democracy. So yeah, it's a real problem.
How did China escape this?
That's a fascinating story, and I tell it in the book. You know, we imposed neoliberalism, the first big neoliberal experiment, in fact, before even the United States got neoliberalism, was in 1976 on 9/11 in 76 in Chile, where the CIA and IT&T engineered a military coup, and Salvador Allende, committed suicide in the presidential palace as they were closing in on him, and General Pinochet took over and privatized Social Security, sold off all the state industries, opened the doors to free trade, did away with the progressive income tax, replaced it with a flat tax, fired about half of all government workers. And the result of that was 300% inflation and a massive economic crash and wild poverty for years and years. And he just kept doubling down on it. When people protested, he murdered them. You know, you see these Proud Boys running around with T-shirts that say free helicopter rides for liberals. That's what Pinochet used to do, is he would take his political opponents or his army would, and take them in helicopters up to a couple thousand feet and throw them out over the Pacific Ocean. Or is it the Atlantic? I forget. Yeah, I think Chile's on the Atlantic side, but whatever, throw them into the ocean. And you know, ultimately it failed. Pinochet got forced out of office. And so then they tried it in Russia. Well, actually, then they tried it in the United States in 1981, but we hadn't, you know, it took a while for it to really sink in what was going on. Then they tried it. We tried it in Iraq. Actually, you know, George W. Well, first we tried it in Russia. In 1991, we imposed neoliberal shock therapy on Russia, and it produced what neoliberalism always produces, which is an oligarchy, you know, the rule by the very rich. And that didn't work out all that well. And so then the third big experiment was L. Paul Bremer, who was an old line neoliberal and friend of Milton Friedman's. Was put in charge of Iraq, and he went in and he fired all the government employees, laid off the entire army, privatized all the industries, said any company in the world can come in, can do business here, won't have to pay a penny in taxes. You can take all the money out of the country you want. You can rob, rape, and pillage Iraq. It's the neoliberal way. And of course, it destroyed Iraq. It led to the death of 500,000 people and about 5 million internal refugees, in addition to the ravages of the war. But the neoliberalism really probably did more damage to Iraq than the war did. And they're still stuck with it. I mean, it's written into their constitution. South Africa is struggling with it too. We helped when Mandela came to power. IBM and a number of other large companies donated lawyers to help them write their constitution, and they wrote corporate personhood right into their constitution. So, and we're seeing the result of that neoliberalism now in South Africa. So, you know, it's every place it's been tried, it has left human misery and devastation in its wake, including the United States. But it's still alive and well in Russia and in Hungary. Those are the two countries, and in Turkey too. You've got now Erdogan imposing neoliberalism. It's kind of the favorite tool of dictators. I think you could say that the Philippines, under Marcos and Duterte, are now, is now a neoliberal state as well. So neoliberalism goes hand in glove with strongman authoritarianism. It's the only way it works.
And Clinton loved it. Bush expanded it, and then Obama rescued it. Am I correct?
Well, yeah. When
overly simplistically, I should say.
Well, no. You're basically summarizing a series of chapters in my book, and the titles kind of say that. Reagan imposed it. George Herbert Walker Bush just kind of maintained it. In fact, he tried to raise taxes a little bit, which cost him his political future because he saw how, what it was doing to the budget deficit. Clinton bought into it completely. We still hadn't seen the warts and flaws, and Clinton thought it was a wonderful thing. And so he expanded neoliberalism in the United States, particularly the free trade part of it. And then George W. Bush came in, and he, in 2002 or 2003, maybe it was 2001, early in his presidency anyway, admitted China into the World Trade Organization, which Reagan, of course, had created through the GATT. I mean, it was created by the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which preceded it, which paved the way for it, was Reagan's. And then Clinton converted that to the WTO. And when Bush took China into the WTO, their entire GDP was only around $1 trillion. I mean, it was the size of Texas economically, a third of the size of California. And now, today their GDP is $19 trillion. They're going to surpass us next year, China, because they said, and what happened was, in fact, I was in China when this happened. I was living in China in November of 1988, and Deng Xiaoping was running the country, and he had these two factions of economic advisors, one group who were looking at, Pinochet and America and saying, we really need to try neoliberalism if we're going to leave behind the managed economy, the communist, state-managed economy. And then you had another group of advisors who were saying, no, we need to follow Alexander Hamilton's American plan from 1793, which was protect your domestic imports, subsidize and assist your domestic manufacturers and invention and R&D, and only allow imports of raw materials and only allow exports of finished goods, and you become the world's manufacturing floor, and that's how you get rich. And we did that from 1791 or 1793 until 1981, until Reagan, and it made us the most rapid and richest country in the world. Our riches came more rapidly than any place else in the world, and of course we've lost much of that since 1981. So there was this huge debate in China that lasted most of that year, 1988, and by 1989 Deng Xiaoping made his decision, and he decided to go with the American plan, Alexander Hamilton's American plan, rather than with neoliberalism. That was also the year that neoliberalism was being pitched in a big way in Russia, although it really took effect the following year. And So by rejecting neoliberalism and instead embracing Alexander Hamilton's American plan and John Maynard Keynes's economic theories, China has become now the richest country in the world. And, you know, we should frankly take a lesson from that.
They also don't get involved in wars. They're very clever that way. They invest in infrastructure. So if they want to get involved in like countries in Africa, they loan them money or build them bridges or schools or power plants rather than bomb them or try to do it at the head of a bayonet.
Yeah, exactly. And it just makes sense. I mean, you know, we sort of did that for a while with banana republics. The problem was that, you know, because we don't have central planning and the state can't dictate everything, we turned most of that over to private companies. So you had Dole Pineapple, you know, that basically owned Hawaii before it became a state. And AT&T owned the phone company in Chile. That's why they, you know, when Allende came in, he nationalized it. And that's why AT&T conspired with the CIA to overthrow Allende. And you know, we did this in country after country, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, throughout Central and South America in particular. And usually we would use the force of our military when there were protests, which is what, you know, Reagan and Ollie North and all that were all about with the Contras. China's doing it, you know, it's still the iron fist, but they put a nice velvet glove over it.
Gee, given what you're rattling off in our history, you'd almost think in a Star Wars way, we were the empire run by the evil emperor and Darth Vader.
Well, we were in many regards. Much of the world saw us that way. And that's why China, frankly, has had as much success with their Belt and Road Initiative as they have. Although it's starting to wear thin. There are countries, because most of what China is doing is not grants, you know, like the Marshall Plan. I mean, we rebuilt Europe and that really established our reputation around the world. And those were not loans. Those were gifts. And we did it. We didn't do it in the way that that China is doing it and that we used to do it, which is, you know, sure, you know, Cuba after the Spanish-American War, we'll rebuild Cuba, but only American companies can come into Cuba to do the work. And they take, you know, and they employ local Cubans at crap wages. And then, you know, they take all the money, all the profit out of the country. You know, instead with the Marshall Plan, what we said is we will pay to rebuild your steel factories and your cement factories and your lumber yards and things. And then you take those raw materials and you hire your own domestic companies and you rebuild your own country. And, you know, with money from us. And that's what happened. And that's why Europe was so prosperous. And then, of course, you know, Harry Truman reached out to the French and the Germans and the Scandinavians and said, as you're rebuilding, by the way, would you please, particularly the Germans, would you please rewrite your constitution as a proof of concept? You know, Harry Truman, you know, proposed a single payer healthcare system in 1947. He couldn't get it through. And because Republicans controlled the House at the time, and but he got the Germans to put one in. Truman wanted a law in the United States that every corporation with over 1,000 employees, half their board of directors had to be made up of representatives of organized labor. He couldn't do that in the United States, but that's in the Constitution in Germany. Truman wanted the law to be. And, you know, the Wagner Act, he wanted it strengthened. The Wagner Act of 1935, the National Labor Relations Act, legalized unions in the United States. He wanted that strengthened. Instead, in 1947, the Republicans in Congress, over Harry Truman's veto, passed the Taft-Hartley Act that gave states the ability to pass right to work for less laws and basically kill unions in those states. Well, Germany, you know, with a wink and a nod from Harry, built that into their constitution. You know, every company in Germany with over 1,000 employees, half their board of directors is made up of union reps who are elected by the unions. So, you know, there's they have a very high minimum wage. They have a 90% unionization rate. This is common all across Europe. These were all things that you know, Democrats in, you know, largely, and especially Harry Truman, he didn't make them conditions of the Marshall Plan, but he was very persuasive, and that's why Europe is in such good shape now, and we're such a wreck.
Well said. And Truman's very underrated because he followed in the shadow of the monumental, maybe the greatest president ever, FDR. And I can't let Truman's name go by without giving praise to my recently dearly departed close friend and mentor, David McCullough, who passed away just a couple of days ago, who through his kindness over 30 years to me in multiple ways will be missed. But he was one of my men. He was like a second father along with my own father. And he wrote, for all of you listening, the definitive, for me, book on Truman that won the Pulitzer Prize. Tom, as an historian, you know the impact the great David McCullough has had on all of us and America.
Yeah, and Truman, I mean, Truman had the same problem LBJ did. We would be looking back on the Great Society and LBJ and saying he was one of our greatest presidents if it wasn't for the Vietnam War. Truman had the same problem with the Korean War. It was very unpopular. And, when Eisenhower ran for president in 52, he wasn't running against Truman at that point anymore. Truman was out of the race. But, his whole there's old TV clips that you can find on YouTube of those TV ads. And it's a cartoon elephant with a big bass drum, you know, like they've got in a marching band, you know, in front of him that he walk with, you know, and on the side of the drum, it says peace. And he's beating the drum. And this voice over says, vote for Truman, vote for peace, a paid film. And vote for Eisenhower, vote for peace. Yeah. I mean, and you know, a paid film. And that was Eisenhower's slogan, you know, I like Ike and vote for peace. And so, you know, we tend to forget all the good stuff that Harry Truman did. And he was a real warrior for democracy, small d democracy, and for the average working person and for unions, and doesn't get anywhere close to the credit that he deserves.
And when if the ETs did come down and anoint me emperor because they had omnipotent power, and they said, all right, who are you going to put in charge of rebuilding America, Ministry of Rebuilding and Undoing Neoliberalism? I'm calling my friend Tom Hartman, who wrote this book, because you have some wonderful things in the book. How do we find our way back after these horrible 40 something years nightmare of this con? Will you talk about some of the things that we could start doing and could do? I know, basically start taxing the rich, break up the monopolies, but will you go into better detail? Because you lay it out really well in the book.
Yeah, well, you know, neoliberalism preached that bigger is better and there's nothing to worry about from monopolies because they're, quote, more efficient, end quote. It turns out it's a lie. We need to go back to small and local owned businesses. We need to be breaking up these giant corporations again. That's, you know, kind of Teddy Roosevelt's thing. When Reagan came into office, the top income tax bracket for people who made over $3 million a year in today's dollars was 74% on every dollar after your 3 millionth dollar. We need to go back to that, or at least something over 50%. Experience all around the world shows that when the very, very, you know, the morbidly rich make over $3 million a year, you should really have to have an over 50% tax rate to encourage them to, instead of hiding that money away in a money bin someplace, put it to productive use in the economy. Hire more people, do R&D, pay your people better, things like that. So we need to take taxes back to where they historically were. I mean, they were 91% from basically World War I right through Reagan. LBJ dropped them down to 74%, but it was actually a tax increase on rich people because he did away with so many of the loopholes that had been drilled into the tax code that at 74%, the government was collecting more revenue from rich people than they were at the 91% before that. So, we need to raise that tax. The corporate tax is obscenely low now. It used to be 50%. And that, again, you know, corporations didn't pay the 50% because rather than pay it, they'd take that money and put it into R&D, which is tax deductible, or developing new products, or developing new sales territories, or hiring new people, or building new factories, all tax deductible things that reduce your tax load. High taxes are actually an incentive to behave well. They're not punishment, they're incentives. And those are a couple of the things that I think, you know, are really important if we want to do this. We also need to reverse the massive privatization of government. About half of our entire defense budget right now is going to private corporations. That's insane. And it's also insanely wasteful. It's why the zip code where all the defense contractors live in Virginia, just north of Washington, D.C., has surpassed Beverly Hills as the richest zip code in America. Ed Snowden, you know, everybody thought he worked for the NSA. No, he worked for a private contractor. All that stuff should come back under the government and at the state and local levels. And we also need to reclaim the commons. Used to be that electricity companies, water companies, sewer companies were all publicly owned by local communities. And now many of them, and our roads, and now many of them are owned by private corporations. There's an Australian toll road company that owns, you know, part of the interstate highway system and owns a bunch of toll roads in the Midwest. You've got a French company that owns water systems all over America. You've got more than half of our electric systems now are owned by for-profit companies, and they regularly rip us off and make things unreliable. PG&E, a private for-profit company in California, was actually convicted of the murder of over 81 people in that Paradise fire because they had the money to upgrade their power lines so that the winds wouldn't tear them down and start fires. But they used that money as bonuses for their executives. And, you know, which wouldn't happen in a nonprofit, you know, community-owned, you know, corporation. So we need to go back to the commons being owned by the people and deprivatize America. Those are the big three things in my mind.
How does neoliberalism work hand in hand with us not dealing with climate change, which is perhaps the greatest threat to our, not only us as a civilization, but as a species?
Well, under neoliberalism, everything is reduced to dollar and cents, to dollars and cents, and on relatively short time horizons, on the assumption that, you know, the future will take care of itself. And so the only way that neoliberals look at climate and climate change and things like that is, you know, in how can somebody make a buck out of this? And you know, this is an existential threat to all of us, and neoliberalism has made the situation much, much worse. We've got to do something about it.
I always like to ask you as we wrap up, what are you working on next? Because it makes me want to go read about it in preparation for your next visit.
The next book, and it'll probably be the last one in the series, which I'm writing right now, is going to be called The Hidden History of American Democracy. And it goes back to the Native American origins of our political system. And I think you'll find it fascinating, Paul.
Would that be the influence of the Iroquois?
Among others, yeah. The Iroquois and the Wendat in particular, yeah.
In a strange way, you answered my, or at least alluded towards my final question of the show here. Are you optimistic about our democracy? You and I sort of lightheartedly, but semi-seriously, said if we get a fascist dictator like DeSantis or Hawley or somebody like that, some Nimrod, the country's in trouble. And with all the voting, you know, suppression laws and all of it, the trickery, apathy, you name it, I feel like this beautiful experiment, which is super imperfect, but like Churchill said, democracy is the worst system except for everything else, feel like we're in more trouble than we realize because we're overly optimistic as a people by nature, the American optimism, just did a show on it. What about you? Are you concerned, worried? Where does your radar stand on our democracy and it's the encroachment of this corporate fascism?
I think the biggest threat to our democracy is the Supreme Court's doctrine that corporations are persons and money is speech. And if something isn't done about that in the next couple of years, and there's a variety of ways to approach that. I wrote a book about it, The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America. If something isn't done about that, then restoring genuine democracy to the United States is going to be an ongoing, very, very difficult struggle. If something is done about that, then I'm very optimistic. Also, you know, we mentioned the 40-year cycles. I really think that people, particularly people under 40, have figured out that neoliberalism is a failure. They may not even know the word, but they know that it's a failure. And so, you know, broadly speaking, I'm optimistic. I think people are sick and tired of their politicians being paid off. I mean, we just learned that Kyrsten Sinema gave a $31 billion tax break to the hedge fund industry in exchange for a $500,000 contribution. I mean, that's such a huge ratio of what you're paying for what you're getting. It doesn't even qualify as prostitution. You know,
that would be the carried interest loophole they keep closing.
That's correct. Yeah. And which wasn't closed and was supposed to be. So, yeah, I see and the neo-fascist militia, enhanced movement in the United States, which I think is a probably fairly predictable response to the economic crisis of the middle class produced by neoliberalism. Those are where I think our biggest challenges lie.
You've been listening to the What Matters Most podcast, a 100% listener-supported program. If you feel inspired, please go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/whatmattersmost and join our family. So until the next time, stay inspired and in the light.